All right, welcome back to the deep dive. We are diving into another fascinating topic that I know you guys are going to be super interested in.
Yeah, you're in the right place if you want to get a good grip on a big idea without having to wade through a ton of details.
Right, we get right to the heart of the matter, and today we are looking at a huge theme throughout the Old Testament, God as restorer.
Really powerful stuff.
Yeah, and to help us unpack this whole concept, we're turning to the work of Dr. Tiberius Rada.
Exactly. We're going to be focusing specifically on his Old Testament Theology Session 7 notes.
Okay, so what's the mission for today's deep dive? What exactly are we hoping to uncover as we go through this material?
Well, the goal is to trace this idea of restoration through the Old Testament, you know, how it shows up, how it develops, and ultimately how the New Testament kind of frames the whole thing.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds like a really fascinating journey.
For sure. And I think it's a journey that's going to resonate with a lot of people, because this idea of restoration, it speaks to something very deep within us, this longing for things to be made right, you know, to be made whole.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that makes Dr. Rada's work so compelling. You know, he really gets to the heart of these big theological ideas and makes them relevant to our lives today.
Right. He doesn't just present dry facts. He connects them to the human experience.
All right, so let's jump right in. One of the first things Dr. Rada points out is this fundamental pattern, this kind of rhythm that we see throughout Israel's story in the Old Testament.
Yeah, he calls it the cycle of sin, judgment, and then, thankfully, restoration.
It's this kind of recurring motif that really seems to shape much of their relationship with God, right?
It's kind of heartbreaking in a way, because you see this constant turning away from God on Israel's part, and then inevitably the judgment follows.
Right. And that judgment often takes the form of exile, right? Being driven out of their land.
Exactly. Like, think about the northern kingdom being conquered by the Assyrians, and then later the southern kingdom being taken captive by the Babylonians.
Yeah. Exile becomes this major repeated theme of judgment in the Old Testament.
Right. And Dr. Rada makes this interesting point about reading the prophets. He says it's easy to get kind of bogged down in the parts about judgment. You know, he even calls them boring and repetitive at times. But
he does. He's pretty blunt about it.
Yeah. Well, he's making a point, I think, because he wants us to look beyond those surface level pronouncements of doom and see those threads of hope, those stubborn promises of restoration that are always there, even in the midst of judgment.
Yeah. I think he's really encouraging us to keep reading, to not get discouraged, because the payoff is so worth it.
For sure. And I think it also speaks to the character of God, doesn't it? Even when he's bringing judgment, he's never abandoned his people. There's always this underlying current of love and a desire to bring them back to himself.
Absolutely. Yeah. It really highlights the fact that God is both just and merciful, that he holds us accountable for our actions, but he's also always ready to forgive and restore us when we turn back to him.
Now, when we talk about this idea of restoration, what exactly do we mean? What does that word really encompass in the biblical context?
Yeah, I mean, in its simplest sense, I guess you could say restoration is about bringing something back to how it was before, right? A return to an original state or condition.
That's a good starting point, for sure. Yeah. But Dr. Rada gives us a more nuanced definition when he's talking about biblical restoration specifically.
What does he say?
He defines it as the renewal of the fortunes of God's people after they experience exile.
Okay, so there's that connection to exile again.
Right. It's not just about restoring a physical object or a building. It's about restoring a people, a nation, to their rightful place, to their covenant relationship with God.
And that connection to the land is so central to the whole idea of restoration, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The land becomes almost a character in this story, a symbol of God's blessing and their identity as his chosen people.
So when people eventually do start to return from exile, it's not just about rebuilding houses and cities. It's about reclaiming their heritage, their inheritance, their connection to the very ground they stand on.
Exactly. It's a restoration on multiple levels, physical, spiritual, and even national.
Okay, so let's look at some of the specific prophetic voices that speak of this restoration. Dr. Rada takes us through a sort of chronological overview, which I think is really helpful.
For sure, starting with Joel. And, you know, even though scholars debate the exact dating of Joel's prophecy, the central message of restoration is super clear.
Yeah, Joel talks about a future return from exile and also this dramatic judgment on the surrounding nations in the Valley of Jehoshaphat.
Right, but the key element for us is that promise of being restored to their land, to that physical place that represents their covenant with God.
And then as we move into the 8th century BC, we encounter prophets like Amos and Hosea, both speaking about this future restoration.
Yeah, Amos paints such a vivid picture of renewal, doesn't he?
Yeah.
It's not just about coming back home. It's about rebuilding their ruined cities, planting vineyards, enjoying the fruits of the land. It's a complete picture of flourishing, of thriving again.
It really is. Yeah, he's painting this beautiful picture of what life could be like when God restores their fortunes.
And Hosea, prophesying around the same time of the southern kingdom, he echoes this message of hope, promising a bountiful harvest when God reverses their fortunes.
It's like this image of barrenness being transformed into abundance, you know, this desolation becoming fruitful again.
Powerful imagery for sure. And then we have Isaiah, another 8th century prophet, but his vision of restoration goes even further.
Yeah, Isaiah's scope is much broader, isn't it? While he talks about the regathering of the tribes of Jacob and the restoration of the remnant of Israel, he also sees Israel as a light to the nations.
Right, it's like this idea of God's salvation, his restoration spilling over, reaching out to the very ends of the earth through Israel.
So it becomes this global picture of renewal, not just limited to one nation.
It really expands our understanding of what restoration can mean.
So we've got Joel, Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, all these different voices from the 8th century. And then we move forward in time to Jeremiah, who lived through a particularly tumultuous period, witnessing the actual destruction of Jerusalem.
Right. This is the 7th and 6th century BC, and things are getting pretty intense for Judah.
And it would be easy to read Jeremiah and just focus on those pronouncements of doom. But what Dr. Rada points out is that even within those warnings, there's this persistent undercurrent of hope, of the promise of restoration.
Yeah, it's not all doom and gloom. In fact, there are some really specific promises of restoration in Jeremiah.
Like that well-known prophecy about the 70 years of exile in Babylon.
Exactly. Yeah, and even when he's talking about that exile, there's always the assurance that it won't last forever, that there will be a return.
It's like he's saying, this is going to be tough, but it's not the end of the story.
Right. God's got a plan, even in the midst of this devastation.
And then there's that whole section in Jeremiah, chapters 30 through 33, often called the Book of Comfort, where he talks about the new covenant.
Yeah, that's huge, because the new covenant itself is really all about restoration. You know, this renewed relationship between God and his people.
It's not just about going back to the way things were. It's about something even better, a deeper level of intimacy and connection with God.
Right. It's a whole new level of restoration, a spiritual transformation.
And then there's that really interesting story in Jeremiah 32, isn't there? Where Jeremiah buys a field, even though the Babylonians are at the gates of Jerusalem.
Yeah, what's that all about? Seems kind of crazy at the time, right?
Totally. But Dr. Rada explains that it's this powerful symbolic act, this tangible sign of hope in the face of utter despair.
He's basically saying, I believe in the future restoration of this land so much that I'm willing to invest in it, even when it looks like all hope is lost.
It's such a bold statement of faith.
For sure. And it points forward to that future restoration in those very regions where everything seems lost.
So we've got all these prophecies about judgment and restoration, and then boom, the exile actually happened.
And that's where the books of Ezra and Nehemiah come in, right? Mm-hmm. They shift from prophecy to history. They show us the actual return from exile.
Okay, so what do we learn from those books about how this whole restoration played out?
One of the key things Dr. Rada highlights is this concept of remnant theology.
Remnant theology, what's that?
It's this idea that even though the whole nation was exiled, not everyone came back. And in fact, God's focus and his promises are carried forward through a faithful remnant, a smaller group who remain true to him.
So it's not about the size of the group. It's about their faithfulness, their commitment to God.
Exactly. And it shows us that God can work through even a small number of people to accomplish his purposes.
So how does this remnant theology play out in the actual return from exile?
Well, mirroring those three waves of deportation into exile, there were also three distinct returns under different leaders.
Okay, break that down for me.
So the first return, which involved around 50,000 Jewish people, was under the leadership of Sheshbazzar, Zerubbabel, and Yeshua.
And what was their main focus?
Rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. That was their priority, to reestablish the center of worship.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, the temple was the heart of their religious life, so rebuilding it was symbolic of their renewed relationship with God.
Exactly. And then the second return was led by Ezra, who was a real spiritual powerhouse, a scholar, a teacher of the law.
So his focus was more on the spiritual side of things.
For sure. He was all about reestablishing the proper observance of God's commands, teaching the people about the Torah, and renewing their commitment to the covenant.
Okay, so first the physical rebuilding of the temple, then the spiritual renewal under Ezra, and what about the third return?
That was led by Nehemiah, who was more of a political leader, appointed as governor by the Persian king.
And what was his big project?
Rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, which is a huge undertaking.
Yeah, the walls were essential for their protection, their security.
Right, so Nehemiah was all about fortifying the city, making it safe and secure.
And he faced a ton of opposition, didn't he?
Oh yeah, constant pushback from those who didn't want to see Jerusalem rebuilt and strengthened.
Like Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem.
Those guys, yeah, they were real thorns in Nehemiah's side.
But Dr. Rada makes a really interesting point about that opposition.
What's that?
He says that facing opposition doesn't necessarily mean you're on the wrong path.
That's thought-provoking.
Yeah, because sometimes when we're doing God's work, we're going to encounter resistance, you know, people who don't want to see God's purposes fulfilled.
Right, so the opposition can actually be a sign that you're on the right track, that you're making a difference.
And Nehemiah definitely persevered in the face of that opposition, didn't he?
He did. And that story about the wall being completed in just 52 days, it's mind-blowing.
It is, yeah. And even their enemies had to acknowledge that God's hand was in it.
Absolutely. It was a clear demonstration of God's power and his faithfulness to his promises.
And then they had all those amazing celebrations, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. The Feast of Booths, the Passover, the dedication of the newly rebuilt wall, all these beautiful expressions of joy and gratitude.
It's like they were finally coming home, both physically and spiritually.
And I think it's important to remember, as Dr. Rada points out, that this return wasn't because Israel suddenly became righteous or deserving. It was purely an act of God's grace. His faithfulness to his promises.
It really highlights the fact that God is the keeper of promises, that he doesn't forget his word, and that his love for his people is unwavering.
And it gives us hope, doesn't it? No matter how far we've strayed, God is always ready to welcome us back and restore us when we turn to him.
So the Old Testament ends with this partial fulfillment of the promised restoration, right? They're back in the land. The temple is rebuilt. The walls of Jerusalem are standing strong.
But was that the full extent of the restoration that the prophets envisioned?
That's a great question. And it leads us right into the New Testament perspective.
Because there's a sense that there's still more to come, that the story isn't over.
And we see this really clearly in Luke chapter 4, don't we? When Jesus reads from the scroll of Isaiah in the synagogue.
Ah, that's a powerful scene. And he chooses a very specific passage from Isaiah 61.
He proclaims good news to the poor, freedom for prisoners, sight for the blind, and release for the oppressed, declaring that this is the year of the Lord's favor.
It's a powerful statement, especially coming from Jesus, who many believed was the Messiah, the one who would bring about God's ultimate restoration.
But when you compare the passage Jesus read with the entirety of Isaiah 61, you realize that he only read a portion of it.
Right. There's more to Isaiah 61 than what Jesus read aloud that day.
It also talks about binding up the brokenhearted, proclaiming not just the year of the Lord's favor, but also the day of vengeance of our God, comforting those who mourn, rebuilding ancient ruins. It's a much bigger picture of complete restoration.
And that raises the question, has all of Isaiah 61 been fulfilled? Or is there still more to come?
And this leads us to Acts chapter 3, where Peter gives that sermon on the day of Pentecost.
Right, and he makes a very interesting statement there. He talks about times of refreshing coming from the Lord.
And he says that God will send Jesus back again.
But here's the key phrase. Until the time for restoring all things about which God spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets long ago.
Restoring all things, that's huge, isn't it?
It suggests that while there was an initial partial restoration with the return from exile, there's still a future, more complete aspect to it that is yet to be fully realized.
So the story's not over. The restoration is still unfolding.
Exactly. And this brings us to some really interesting ideas that Dr. Rada discusses, based on the work of scholar N.T. Wright.
What does Wright have to say about this?
Well, Wright argues that the restoration of Israel is not yet complete. He believes that for many within the Jewish community, the sense of exile persisted. You know, even after the return from Babylon, there was still this longing for God's full and final redemption of his people.
So it becomes about more than just a physical return to the land.
Right. It's about a deeper spiritual restoration, a complete reconciliation with God.
And this connects to what Paul says in Romans 11, doesn't it? Where he talks about all Israel will be saved.
Exactly. Yeah, that points to this future large-scale turning of the Jewish people to Christ, which would be an incredible fulfillment of God's promises of restoration.
And Wright points out that even after the return from Babylon, some of those really glorious and triumphant messages from the prophets, they remained unfulfilled.
Right, like Israel was still under foreign rule. They weren't fully independent. And that promised visible return of God's glory to Zion. That hadn't really happened in its fullness.
So there was this sense that they were still waiting, still hoping for something more.
Exactly. And we even see that sense of longing reflected in later Jewish writings, like the Book of Sirach, which was written in the 2nd century BC.
What does Sirach say?
Well, the author, Yeshua ben Sira, he still viewed Israel as oppressed, and those who were scattered abroad as still in a state of exile.
So even centuries after the return from Babylon, that sense of displacement, of not being fully restored, it lingered.
It did. And we even find exilic imagery in even later writings like the Dead Sea Scrolls and 2nd Baruch, which were written after the time of Jesus.
And what do those writings say about restoration?
They talk about a future rebuilding of Zion, a restoration of the temple offerings and the priesthood. But even then, there's a sense that it might not be exactly the same as it was before.
So there's this ongoing conversation about what true restoration will look like, how it will be fulfilled.
Right. And it all points to this deeper reality that God's plan of restoration extends beyond just the physical and historical realm. It encompasses the spiritual and ultimately the eschatological, the end times.
So when we think about Jesus and his ministry, it's interesting to consider the symbolism, isn't it? Like, why did he choose 12 disciples?
That is interesting, isn't it? Could it be a deliberate connection back to the 12 tribes of Israel?
It's possible, right? Like maybe he was symbolically reconstituting the 12 tribes, laying the foundation for that ultimate restoration.
That's a pretty cool thought. And then there's that statement Jesus makes in Matthew 19.28, where he tells his disciples that they will sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel in the new world.
So there's definitely this connection between the disciples and the 12 tribes, and it seems to point to their future role in God's plan of restoration.
And it suggests that a fully restored Israel would, in a sense, be a return to that idealized period before the exile, you know, a time when God was directly recognized as their king.
So it's not just about going back to the way things were. It's about something even better, something more glorious.
Right. It's about the ultimate fulfillment of God's purposes for his people.
And it seems like some of those prophecies about restoration, especially those about the complete reclaiming of the land and the full visible reign of God in Zion, they might only be fulfilled in the eschaton, in the end times.
That makes sense, because those prophecies seem to go beyond what was accomplished in the initial return from exile.
And Dr. Rada points out this fascinating connection between Jesus' words in Mark 13 and the prophecy of Zechariah.
Yeah, what's he talking about there?
Well, in Zechariah chapter 2, which was written after the return from Babylon, there's this call to flee Babylon.
Okay, so even though they're back in the land, there's still this imagery of fleeing Babylon.
Right, and it speaks of God dwelling in Zion and many nations joining themselves to the Lord.
So it seems to have a deeper meaning than just the physical return from exile.
Exactly. And Dr. Rada suggests that it's pointing forward to the end times, to that final restoration when God's presence will be fully manifested in Zion.
And how does that connect to Jesus in Mark 13?
Well, Jesus uses very similar language. He describes cosmic disturbances, the gathering of his elect from the four winds. It all echoes that eschatological tone found in Zechariah.
So he's picking up on that same theme, that same future hope of complete restoration.
And he's connecting it to his own return, to the culmination of God's plan for the world.
So as Dr. Rada concludes, Jesus' ministry marked the beginning of the end of Israel's long exile.
There was that initial historical dimension with the return from Babylon and then the impact of Jesus' own ministry. But the ultimate and complete restoration of all things, that's still a future hope.
To be fully realized when Christ returns.
Okay, wow. So let's try to pull all of this together.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here.
What we see throughout the Old Testament is this consistent picture of God as a restorer. You know, even when his people turn away, even when they face judgment, the promise of restoration is always there, like this golden thread running through the story.
Right. It's like that dark cloud of judgment always has this silver lining of hope, this promise that God will make things right in the end.
And then the New Testament adds this really crucial layer, showing us that while there was an initial fulfillment of that restoration with the return from exile, the ultimate fulfillment, the complete restoration of all things, that's still to come.
And it's tied to the return of Christ, to that final culmination of God's plan.
So it's like we're living in this in-between time, this time of anticipation, where we can experience glimpses of restoration in our own lives and in the world around us, but we're still waiting for that full and final restoration when everything will be made new.
And that leaves us with a really powerful question to ponder, doesn't it?
What's that?
How might this concept of divine restoration speak into broader historical cycles of brokenness and renewal? Can we see God at work in those larger movements of history, bringing healing and hope to a fractured world?
Yeah, that's a great question.
And on a more personal level, how does this idea of God as a restorer resonate with the brokenness and the longings for healing and wholeness that we experience in our own lives?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does it look like for God to be a restorer in your own personal story, in your relationships, in your community?
Those are amazing questions to consider.
Yeah, because ultimately this idea of restoration is not just some abstract theological concept. It's a reality that can touch every aspect of our lives if we allow it to.
And that's what makes this whole deep dive so powerful, so relevant to who we are and how we live.
For sure, it's a reminder that even in the midst of brokenness and exile, God is always working to bring us back, to restore us to wholeness, to himself.
And that's a message that I think we all need to hear.
Absolutely.
All right, so I hope you've enjoyed this deep dive into the concept of God as restorer.
Yeah, thanks for joining us on this journey.
And until next time, keep seeking, keep questioning, keep diving deep.
Keep going deeper.
We'll see you soon.
Take care.